And when he talked to Bill, he'd been sober 2.5 to 3 months. He was living at Calvary Mission, and he had been instructed by the last tenet or idea, the sixth idea of the Oxford groups, that those who have been changed must change others. And he thought who he could help, and he said, I wonder where Bill is. And he wandered down on Wall Street, asked him if he'd seen Bill, and they said, no, Bill's been drunk since Armistice Day, you haven't seen him. And so he called him. Bill said, it was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wonder how he had escaped. Well, what had happened to Abby was that Abby's family was a politically notorious family in Albany, New York. The Thatcher family had been, at the time, his brother was a mayor, his father had been mayor, politically visible people in the Albany area. Everybody except Abby. And so the family had said, Abby, we got a job for you. Why don't you go up and take care of the summer place up in the Berkshire Mountains, just kind of take care of it. And he thought that was a big assignment. But, of course, what they were doing is they were trying to get him out of the public eye because he was a bad actor down in Albany. And they were so the Thatcher people, the manufacturing people, made wheels for boxcars or gondolas, railroad wheels, those steel wheels, Thatcher manufacturing. And his father almost ran for governor of state of New York. This was a kind of powerful family. They put Bill up here in the family home, the summer home, taking care of it up in the Berkshire Mountains. And so Abby took that seriously, and he went up there. But he couldn't stay sober. One morning, he was driving his dad's old car, and he lost control of it, and he ran slap into this house, and he ended up in the kitchen. And so he got out of his car. He's drunk, and he doffed his hat, they say. And the lady and the man of the house were there, and he said, morning, madam. He said, isn't it a fine morning to have a cup of coffee? And she wasn't as happy as he was. And she'd called the police, and there was a thing, and he got in trouble over that, and they told him not to mess up again, and he'd be all right. And a little while later, he'd been out painting that old place, and one day went out there, and some pigeons were up on the roof crapping on his new paint job. And so he got the shotgun out, and he was shooting pigeons off the roof of the house, and they got him again. And they took him before this judge, Judge Graves. Nobody knew at the time, another one of these providential things, but nobody knew at the time that Roland Hazard, who we talked about before and we'll talk about more later, was working with a couple of guys, and one of the guys that he was working with trying to get sober was Judge Graves' son, Seber Graves. And so Judge Graves said, well, they've been having some luck with my son. Maybe I'll turn Abby over to these guys instead of sending him off to the slammer. And so he did. But Bill had heard that he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity, and he wondered how he escaped. He escaped because the judge gave him over to Roland and Shep and the judge's son, Seber Graves.
He said, of course he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that.
This is a literal story. They were opening an airport that they'd built in Manchester, New Hampshire, and it was to be the grand opening. And the lieutenant governor was there, the local city council and town council and everything, and they were waiting for the inaugural flight to come in.
And they had the band there, too.
They had the band. But Abby and Bill and a pilot who was a drunk also, they chartered this airplane. And instead of the inaugural flight coming in, they came in first and landed. And they tried to get out of the airplane, and they fell because they were all drunk. And here the cameras are, and the band's playing. And so, you know, that was quite an event. Bill remembers that, and he points it out here. But that's the kind of a drinker Bill was, and that was the kind of relationship he had with Abby. So you see, this is important because Abby didn't have to come to Bill and say, let me tell you, he didn't have to qualify. because he already had qualified for Bill.
Yeah. He said the door opened and he stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's this all this about, I queried. He looked straight at me simply but smilingly. He said, I've got religion.
But I'm glad it didn't happen in my kitchen. This is a big shutdown for Bill now. Abby telling him I got religion. But this is an important juncture because you watch. We know that Bill had toyed with spiritual things, don't we? We know about his encounter in Winchester Cathedral. We know what happened in there. We know, if you read the history, that his grandfather, who had a great influence on his life, was an immensely spiritual guy. He wasn't a very religious guy. He knew there was a power of the universe, a big scheme of it all, yet he defied and argued against anybody telling him how to practice it. And so we'll see this wrestling in Bill's mind for the next several pages as he goes back and forth with the spiritual versus religion problem. Ebby says, I got religion, the big shutdown. Let's see what happened.
He said, I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart, let him ramp. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching.
Now remember that Bill already knows the problem because Silkworth told him the problem. He's powerless, he can't drink because of the physical allergy, and he can't quit because of the mental obsession. So he already knows what the problem is. He's been told that. Let's see what Ebby brings in, if Ebby doesn't bring in some other information which is valuable.
He said, but he did know Ranny. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told him of a simple religious idea.
They told him about the need of a power greater than human power, the second step, the solution to the problem,
and the practical program of action.
They told him about the six ideas of the Oxford group, which, if they put them into practice, would permit them to access the power of recovery. So Bill knew the one thing Silkworth had told him. Now he knows two more things. And Ebby brings him these other two vital pieces of information, the solution and the practical program of action, which, if he practiced, would permit him to access the solution. It's interesting again to note that while Ebby brought this information to him, they didn't come from Ebby. The need for a power greater than human power came from Roland, and he got it from Dr. Carl Jung. And the idea of a simple program of action came from the Oxford Group basic program.
He said that was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. Now we can see that Bill has all three of the pieces of the puzzle he needs to do something about his alcoholism. He knows what the problem is, he knows what the solution is, and he has a program of action by which to access the solution. He said he had come to pass his experience along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folks and their doing. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen.
See him wrestle between the idea of spirituality, of being a czar of the universe, setting things in motion, but his resistance at religion, somebody telling him how to practice it.
He said his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. And so see, that was when he really saw this. And Dick explained last night the depth of the feeling that Bill had when he was in Winchester Cathedral. He said, I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone.
See, Bill doesn't have any trouble with spirituality, just like his grandfather didn't. He doesn't have any trouble with that. But Emmy said, I got religion. So watch what Bill says in the next paragraph.
He said, with ministers and the world's religions, I parted right there.
Doesn't like religion, see. Doesn't like to be told how to practice these things that he thinks he believed in.
Yeah, he's going back and forth and back and forth. And the one overriding factor in this whole, you can see him vacillating back and forth. He'd go from one side to the other side to the other side. But the controlling factor in this whole deal is Bill, as an alcoholic, cannot rationalize and he cannot explain away Ebby Thatcher. Because, you know, he can have all of these ideas that he wants to, and he can justify this and he can justify that. And then he looks over and right across the table is Ebby Thatcher, cold, stone, sober, and Bill cannot rationalize that away. But he tries. He said,
when they talked.
Yeah, he said, when they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded.
Anybody have any trouble? Anybody have any trouble identifying with Bill's attitudes in this area?
I can identify with Bill Wilson right now. Let's skip a paragraph. He said, but my friend sat before me and he made the point blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself.
Can't rationalize Ebby away.
He said, doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and that was none at all.
So he recognized that in Ebby there was a power in the transformation of what Ebby was that day from what he had known him to be in the past. Did not come from Ebby power, but came from a power.
Larry,
turn your.
I'm
turn
trying
your
to do a big book study. How are you? Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. We started this morning at 9:00.
Turn your mic off.
And I forgot and left my.
If you're an important businessman, that happens. You got the. See, he recognized here that whatever transformation he saw in Ebby had come from a power greater than human power, greater than Ebby power, and he kept. This was, as Jerry said, this was the great neutralizer, the very thing that Bill couldn't rationalize away and couldn't argue with was the fact that Ebby had religion. He was sitting across from him. He'd been sober 2.5 to 3 months. He'd never seen him like that before. He knew he was a real alcoholic, and he knew that that power that did that came from a power greater than Ebby power. Flip over a page to page 12.
First paragraph on page 12. He said, despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way.
See him going back and forth here. He goes from one, then he goes to the other. First he's agreeing with things, and then he's finding ways not to agree with it. Tremendous clash in Bill's mind. Maybe if we can identify with him in our approach to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's been some tremendous clashes in our own mind as we tried to deal with the spiritual nature of the program. There was in Bill's.
He said, I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. He said, my friend then suggested what seemed like a novel idea. Now notice this is in squiggly writing again. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God?
Now the message changed from religion to spiritual. Why don't you choose your own conception of God? What a breakthrough for Bill. Now he can choose his own conception of God. Makes sense. And besides, as a real alcoholic, who can resist the temptation to have their own conception of anything? And so this is a great factor. This statement here in italics is a great pivotal point in the entry point to a program that saves or offers to save yours and my life. What would have happened if this relationship had broken down in the kitchen? But it doesn't. At this particular point, when Ebby makes this statement, their relationship begins to take some meaning, and what happened there, that exchange of information, begins to get off the ground.
He said, that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw the growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, might I build what I saw in my friend? Would I have it? Of course I would. Okay.
Now in this paragraph and the one that follows, we know that Bill's already got the idea of powerlessness and unmanageability. What was to become the first step in his mind. Now we think in these two paragraphs, we can see where Bill conceptually puts into place in his mind the beginning of the solution, where he says that it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself, a power greater than human power. And he says, he makes a statement, upon the foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend, because he knew that the power that Ebby manifested that day did not come from Ebby power, came from a power greater than Ebby power.
He said, thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes, and a new world came into view.
Now we think that Bill conceptually took the idea which was to become step two. And we use the arch chart. Joe and Charlie don't use the arch chart, but Jerry and I use the arch chart because we think it puts together visually what begins to happen right here in Bill's kitchen, of the building which they're talking about. Now here they're just talking about a building. And he says, upon the foundation of complete willingness, might I build what I saw in my friend? Of course I would. So he's talking about the foundation down here, right down the bottom. He can't see it. I'll pull it up so he can. He's talking about the foundation of willingness. He's going to build something. He doesn't tell what it is, but he's telling us one thing. He's going to build something. That's all he tells us. We're going to put this a little more together because he's going to talk about more in the future about what he's building. But right here he says, step one, giving up, getting some willingness, that's the foundation of something that I'll build.
Okay. Now we're going to go over to the top of the next page.
13.
But let me just make a few comments here before we get into this. You know, we have seen all through Bill's story what a remarkable man that Bill was, and how he could summon up the power to do just unbelievable things when he got his act together, which was fewer and fewer during the end. But I always thought that God had just like drilled a little hole in Bill's head, and he poured all of this program in here for us, and that Bill was given the total gift of sobriety, and he was a very blessed individual. Well, he was a blessed individual, and we were blessed to have him. But when we look on this page that we're fixing to come to now, let's see if we can't see where Bill conceptually got sober exactly like we do. You know, I thought this white flash and everything he had in the hospital, God just hit him with a magic wand like a fairy godmother, and that was the end of it. But if we really look carefully on this page we're about to go over, we can see that Bill Wilson in his mind was conceptually doing the same things that we have to do when we work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the result is exactly the same thing that happens to us. But that white flash that he had in the hospital was a result of the things that he had already done before. It wasn't just a stroke of luck or anything like that. And let's see if we can't see how that came about. And Bill's been trying to practice this program for 2 or 3 weeks. Now, he bought in 100% to what Ebbie Thatcher told him. I mean, he bought into that lock, stock, and barrel. And he's been trying to he's even been to some Oxford group meetings. Gave his testimony when they got him sober enough to do it. But there's one little teeny problem Bill's having trouble with. He is trying his dead level best to work this program to the best of his ability. But Bill's still drunk. And this program works considerably better if we're not drinking. So they sent him back to the hospital.
Now remember, as he goes into the hospital this time, that he's got these two pieces of information in his mind that we read about on page 8. About no words can tell the what was going to become step one. And on page 12, where in two paragraphs he conceptually puts in his mind the idea of a need for power greater than human power. So with these two pieces of information conceptually in his mind, let's see what happens. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of DT.
Okay, now this is on the 11th of December, 1934, and his admission slip to Towns Hospital says 2:30 p.m. So they took him into the hospital at 2:30 on the 11th of December, 1934.
Well, let's see what happens to Bill now while he's in Towns Hospital. Remember again that he's got these first two pieces of information conceptually in his mind. He says, "There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him. To do with me as he would, I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost."
Does that not sound remarkably like what's later going to become our step three?
So we think
it sounds exactly like Bill is doing what we do in step three. He is making the decision to turn his will and his life over to the care of God.
"I ruthlessly faced my sins."
Now, well, they changed the language of this a little bit because Bill understood that we're real alcoholics. And, you know, before, when he changes, ruthlessly faced his sins.
Okay, and he continues on to say, "Not only was I ruthlessly facing my sins, I became willing to have my newfound friend," that's capital F. He's not talking about Ebbie or Dr. Silkworth either. When he's got to use his caps, he's talking about God. So his newfound friend, "I was willing to have him take them away, root and branch."
And that sounds like what's going to later become step 6 and 7.
Humbly asked him to remove our shortcoming, became entirely ready to have him remove them, and humbly asked him to remove them. Sounds like that. He says, "I've not had a drink since." That was sometime after December 11th, 1934, when he was discharged from the hospital. He never drank again up until the time of his death in January of 1971. He said, "My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies."
Now, that is Ebbie.
That is Ebbie.
But that sounds a lot like what's later going to become step 5, shared with another human being.
"Said we made a list of the people I had hurt and or towards whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability."
Sounds a lot like what's going to become 8 and 9.
"I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense."
Sounds like step 10.
"Continue to take personal inventory, testing all the time against this new standard, these new ideas. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength
to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure.
Okay, so that sounds like what's later going to become step 11. Now, you know, step 12 is a three-part step. And let's see if we can't pick out the parts of step 12 as he goes along.
My friend, small f, that is Ebby, promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
Now, that sounds like the first part of the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of this action that he's taken on this page, Ebby says he's going to have a whole new relationship with his Creator. That's the first part of the 12th step that's coming around right here.
Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements to bring about the first third of what was later to become step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these previous 11 steps, which we see Bill has taken because he had conceptually the first two in his mind. We saw him taking the others.
He says, simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all.
We must give up the two things that are most important to us, alcohol and self-centeredness, the two most important things for me, the alcoholic, alcohol and self-centeredness.
He said these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound.
Here's where we get the idea that Bill was just kind of lying there in the hospital, been there a couple of days, got feeling better, got getting the alcohol out of his system. Bang! He had this spiritual experience and felt like a wind coming through and these things. But again, we know that this is a result, as we read these pages, this is a result of the same process that's going to be suggested for you and I to follow if we're going to have the spiritual awakening that's promised in the first part of step 12.
Now Bill thought he was crazy. He thought that he really had gone nuts. He said, for a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, something has happened to you. I don't understand, but you better hang on to it, because anything is better than the way you were. The good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows that they are real. He said, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others.
The second third, or the middle third part of step 12, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. And Bill, the idea came to Bill as he lay there in the hospital after he'd done the first 11 steps in his mind and had that spiritual awakening that we know he had. The idea came to his mind that if he was to pass this on to other alcoholics, it'd be a great idea. The center part of the 12th step.
He said, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs.
That is Ebby.
Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic.
See, the last part of the 12th step says to practice these principles in all our affairs. And we see that Ebby and Bill had shared this idea, which was eventually to become the last part of the 12th step. So we see here, I think, in these two pages, I hope we see, where Bill got his spiritual experience, or what happened to Bill when he recovered from the disease of alcoholism, happened in the same identical sequence that is suggested for you and for me. The first step, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. The second step, where it says it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself, what he'd seen in Ebby. The third step, and fourth and fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth and 10th and 11th that we see on page 13, and the 12th step in three parts on 13 and 14. So he recovers in the same identical way that we're told we must recover, and that's by taking the steps. We're going to go over to chapter 2 now, and this ends the problem portion of the big book study. The first goal in the big book study is to tell us about the problem. We had the problem described for us in the doctor's opinion. Powerless, no power, zero power. We're told several times that we must buy into this 100% or there's no chance of recovery. No sense in me worrying about a solution if I really don't know what the problem is. So we found out about the problem, no power, powerlessness in the doctor's opinion, and then we've seen an example of it in Bill's story. Not only have we seen an example of the progression into alcoholism as we see the deterioration of his emotion, his relationships, his ability to drink, his use of alcohol, but we also watch him recover. Not a great deal of attention paid to this, but you see there's some hope for the reader of the book. There's hope for you and I, because here's a guy that thought, felt, and drank like you and I thought, felt, and drank, and yet he recovered. And he never drank again until the day of his death in 1971. So there's hope in Bill's story, just exactly where it belongs. It ends the first goal of the big book study, the problem, and we move into the second goal, which is a solution. And we found out when we looked at those goals last night that if the first problem is no power, then the solution is
power.
Great. Great. Yeah. What a great class. And so we're going to move into three chapters now to discuss the solution, power. And Bill's going to do this in a peculiar way. He's going to show us the need for power. He's going to show us how to find the power, and he's going to show us where the power is. And Bill has a unique way of teaching. I love it. And you watch it as we go on through this. Bill knows the alcoholic. So he's going to go through these three chapters, and he's going to teach us by a unique method. He's going to whittle away at all the notions and ideas that we'll have that we can't apply this, that this doesn't apply to us. Bill is a real alcoholic. He knows how you and I would think, and he knows the resistance that we'd put up and the ideas that we have. So we're going to whittle away at those. Watch him. He's very subtle. He's cunning. And he'll whittle away at these so that we no longer have these barriers and this resistance.
Okay, now this chapter is called There Is a Solution. And what Bill's going to do in this particular chapter is he is going to discuss two powers. He is going to discuss the power of the fellowship. And then he is going to discuss the power of the vital spiritual experience, which comes as a result of working these steps in the program. Okay? And he's going to tell us, he's going to use the whole first half of this chapter explaining to us why the power of the fellowship will not keep us sober on a continuous basis. He's going to tell you why that will not happen and explain that this is one of the first great traps that we can fall into. Because when we come to the fellowship, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you get to hug all the good-looking girls and drink coffee and spit cake crumbs all over everybody, and it's a wonderful, non-threatening place to be. And a lot of times we see people that come into the fellowship and they get caught up in these warm fuzzies, and they forget to continue to work on themselves through the program that's in the book. And when we do this, we're setting us up for a fall. And Bill's going to explain this in this chapter. He's going to use the first half to tell you why the fellowship by itself will not work. And then he's going to tell us what the real solution is. Now, that's going to help us a great deal if we understand how Bill writes. Because Bill was an educated man. He sent himself through college. And he uses a lot of words to say the same thing. He doesn't want to appear dumb, so he'll use 15 words, if you can, and he'll say the same thing. So what he does is he's going to tell us basic concepts over and over and over and over again in this program. That's what he's going to do. They use different words, and we don't need to get caught up in that about what word he uses for what, because he just uses them as they come to him. There's no rhyme or reason to it. Another thing he does
is Bill likes to tell stories. And you know, these things are called parables. And we had another teacher a couple of thousand years ago that was really good at this. If he wanted to talk to shepherds, he told them stories about sheep. And if he wanted to talk to fishermen, he told them stories about fish. And Bill does this a lot. And the object of this is that we use an example of something that we know something about in order to make a point about something that we maybe don't know anything about. And Bill does this too. So let's just watch him and see what he does when he's up.
And he's talking about two powers, the power of the fellowship and another power, which if combined, and he's going to describe them here, if combined, may be strong enough to relieve the obsession. And that's what I need to do to have a psychic change so that it's not necessary for me to take that first drink. He says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved their drink problem. I use this term recovered again. Don't spend a lot of time at your group tonight or tomorrow night or whenever you go back arguing whether or not this is an accurate term, word, recovered versus recovering, because you'll argue all meeting long about it. But we want to emphasize again that back in 1938, when this book was written, sufficient number of people were not drinking to permit them to use the word recovered, because up until now, nobody recovered to the extent that they were experiencing here. So we think they can use the word recovered with accuracy, and we ought to spend a lot of time arguing about it, okay? We are average Americans, he said. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds.
If you look around this group today, we are probably one of the more diverse groups that you will see anywhere. You know, we're different races, different nationalities, different occupations, different financial status, different everything. And we are normally people who would not mix. You know, because most people, when they get together, they have a common thing that brings them together. You know, like family or occupation or religion or something of that nature. But we are really diverse. We are people who normally would not come together.
And he says that. We're people who normally would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, an understanding, which is indescribably wonderful. And we know that and we feel that. I love that first meeting I went to, sick as I was, that Sunday night in Burlington, North Carolina. I loved the feeling there. I knew that I was in a non-threatening environment. I was among friends. You understood. Nobody had understood. I could tell it in your eye. I could tell it in the way you smile. I love it. Still love it today. Love being with you people. Loved it Wednesday night at Matthews. Loved it Tuesday night at Indian Trail. Monday night at Matthews. Sunday night at Wilma's group. Where's David? And I still love it, the power of the fellowship. People who normally would not mention, but there exists a fellowship of friendliness, understanding, indescribably wonderful. He said, we are like passengers in a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table.
Now, here's his first little story. He said, from steerage to captain's table. And he uses this little example because of the Titanic had gone down. Okay, and as a result of the movie, probably everybody's familiar with the Titanic today. And the Titanic, the ship that he's talking about, was laid out probably like cruise ships are today. You know, if you have a lot of money, and you have the right kind of money back then, you had an upper berth on the top deck of the Titanic and with lavish staterooms, and you could have dinner with the captain, and you would eat lobster and steak and whatever the captain was having for dinner. You could participate in that. And as you went down through the ship, the accommodations became a little less and a little less. You know, you'd drop on the lower deck and they did this. Well, the upshot of the thing was that down in the bottom of this ship, completely separated from the rest of these passengers, they've got the steerage section, which is down in the bottom, and they don't have portholes because it's underwater. And they are in there, and there are three high bunk beds, and they're eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And these people don't have a clue what's going on the top deck, and these people on the top deck don't even know that these people are down here. They would not mix at all. But let me tell you something. When that sucker hit that iceberg and their tail hit that water, there wasn't any difference in anybody. They were all trying to escape the disaster that had befallen them. And that is the way we are. Our fellowship is a result of the common peril that we've been subjected to.
Having shared a common peril. That's the one thing that brings us so closely together. What brings about the fellowship, the friendliness, and the understanding here is that we have shared in that common peril. Like a shipwreck when their butts hit the water. A common peril. But look, we know that the people in the ship parable or story, the Titanic story, that once they're rescued, those that do get rescued, and by the Coast Guard or fishing vessels or whatever, and carried back to shore and put on safe land, that the people who were living in the country club area and had been eating with the captain, they go back to the country club area and their lavish lifestyle, mm-hmm. and the guy and gal who were working in the plant or driving a forklift or eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches that lived in the steerage section of the vessel or were in the steerage section, they go back to their everyday jobs at the local plant. But here's what he says about us. He says, unlike the feelings of the ship passengers, however, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. These others go their individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is the one element of the powerful cement which binds us. We already talked about that. We've shared in the common peril of alcoholism. But he says that in itself would never have held us together as we're now joined. What he's saying in there is that the common peril is an element in the cement that holds us together, but it's not the most important element. There's another element in the cement that holds us together. And he says a tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. And that, he says, is the most powerful element in the cement that holds us together. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism.
Now see, he says that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. You know, if the warm fuzzies and the fellowship could actually keep us sober on a continuous basis, we wouldn't need the rest of the program. We could just take up the songbooks and go home right now. They wouldn't be but 17 pages in the book, because all we'd have to do would be get you into the fellowship and everything would be all right. But unfortunately, that is not the case. There are people who are very active in the fellowship who are literally dying of untreated alcoholism. Okay, first, now we're going to page 20.
First caution, this is a great caution, flag of caution, because especially today, it wasn't a great problem back in the early days, because the fellowship and the program were the same. The fellowship wasn't that strong. But nowadays, folks, you and I know that the fellowship is very powerful. And meetings are large, we have great meetings, a lot of people, always a chance to identify with someone. And this fellowship is very strong, but it's a great trap, and we have to be careful here. There's a flag of caution. The fellowship is not enough. Don't get trapped in that fellowship. Don't let people you're working with get trapped in the fellowship, because it's not sufficient. It's not the most important element in the cement that holds us together. Now, he's going to tell us what that important element more description is later on. It's bad news. I'll give you a warning. It's not good news for us. He's going to tell us what that is a little later on, and it's not good news. I wish that more important element in the cement was a change of climate, exercise program, green leafy vegetable diet, younger wife, those kind of things, but that's not what's going to be. I'll flip over to page 20.
Okay, first paragraph.
First paragraph on page 20.
He said, you know, I told you earlier that Bill repeats himself a lot. He said, you may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us become so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? He said, it's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically.
Not generally. Don't give you some ideas that you can bounce off your mind and consider. That wouldn't be much of a book for alcoholics, because we'd screw that up, sure enough, you know. But he says here that the purpose of that, when we ask the question, what do I have to do to recover from this hopeless condition of mind and body? What do I have to do? And he says, the purpose of this book is to answer that question specifically. It's kind of like precisely that we used before. It's not a general term. This book is designed to answer that question, quote, what do I have to do, specifically.
He said, we shall tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them.
Now, he wants to again, he hopes by now that after you've read the doctor's opinion, seen an example of Bill's story, that you understand what the real alcoholic is. But Bill likes to repeat himself, as Jerry said. Now, he's going to run it by us again. He wants to make sure that we understand who the real alcoholic is and how the real alcoholic differs somewhat from some other people who drink. We want to make sure we understand that again, and he begins right here.
He said, how many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fella can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake.
He's such a sweet guy, I would think she'd stop for his sake. You can make the gender perfect if you want to use your own description.
The doctor told him if he ever drank again, it would kill him. Now there he is all lit up again. Now these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours.
Why? Because these observations and these reactions were made by people who did not drink, or the 9 out of 10 drinkers who could drink successfully. That's why these commonplace observations were backed up by ignorance and misunderstanding. That's not a derogative statement, it's the truth. Those who have been diagnosing, prescribing, and enforcing the prescription were that group of people up until the early 30s who either didn't drink or who drank successfully.
Now, there are two classes of people that these observations do apply to, and we're going to go into them. He said, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone.
Now, this is a moderate drinker. This is the first drinker he's going to talk about that are not alcoholic. We talked about them earlier on. They take a couple of drinks, they begin to feel the effects of it, they get a little tipsy and nauseous, then they set it up and they don't drink anymore. Or they get tired or sleepy and want to take a nap, don't drink anymore. They feel out of control and don't like feeling out of control, and they don't drink anymore. We found out that when they begin to feel the effects of alcohol, they're ready to quit. The moderate drinker.
Okay, so then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change in environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention.
The hard drinker drinks like an alcoholic, not an alcoholic. Drinks like an alcoholic, not an alcoholic. We've heard them tell this before. I was in the service, I was overseas, I drank like an alcoholic, drank all the time, came back home, got married, settled down, got a job, got a house with a white picket fence. Not a problem for me anymore. We've heard about these guys. I tell the story of when I was a strapping teenager, which was a long while ago. I was kind of physically, working-wise, in demand from the local farming community. They'd like me to help them. And there was a Polish family who ran a farm down near me who would haul 5-ton truckloads of grain into the Grains League Federation, the GLF, and then they'd grind it into mash for the cattle and the horses. And we'd do that three loads a day and bring that stuff on back, and they liked me to help them shovel that stuff on there. And these guys would stop on the way into town at a place called Vince's, where you could buy bottom shelf whiskey for 30 cents a shot and a 10 cent draft Genesee beer. And they'd throw a buck on the bar, and they'd drink three shots fast and chase it with an 8 ounce of Genesee draft beer, get back in the truck, go in and unload it, stop on the way back, go out and load another one, and they'd do that three times. Six times they'd stop at Vince's. Hard drinkers. The next morning at 4 o'clock, they're up hand milking 29 head of cattle. Go on about their life the next day. Hard drinkers. Drink like alcoholics, not alcoholics. If you looked at them the day we were doing that work, you'd say, these guys are alcoholics. They're not. Because they're able to drink, they drink hard, look like alcoholics, not alcoholics.
He said, well, what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink.
These questions over here on the previous page, you can take it or leave it alone. I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why did he drink like a gentleman? They don't apply to the real alcoholic. They won't work in the case of the real alcoholic.
He said, here's a fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredibly tragic things while drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. But in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses a special ability, skills, and aptitudes, has a promising career ahead of him. He uses these gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees.
Can identify with that, anybody?
He is the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around, yet early next morning he's searching madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before.
When I shall awake, I will seek it yet again.
Yeah. He said if he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe.
That's a toilet back then, waste pipe.
As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work.
Dual addiction.
Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitaries.
Now, because of education, if we've used the public dollar wisely in one area, it's been in the area of alcohol and alcoholism education. And because of the wise use of public money in those areas and the greater knowledge of the disease of alcoholism that's widespread, not only in the public sector, but industry and commerce, with the employee assistance programs and things of this nature, we may not have to go this far today. People may not have to go to the point of appearing at hospitals and sanitariums today because they know so much more about the disease. There's so much more available out there. May be able to get off the elevator a little bit quicker than you could back then. Skip one paragraph.
And that little bitty one. He said, why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink?
Now, if you're alcoholic, you found yourself up here in this paragraph about the real alcoholic someplace. If you're not alcoholic, then you found your alcoholic up there in that paragraph someplace. But now he's going to say, why does he behave like this?
Yeah, he said, why does he take that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters?
Number one, the first drinker, the moderate drinker, he can. She can. The heavy drinker, not the alcoholic, he can or she can. But why can't the real alcoholic?
He said, perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion.
And we've already talked about this when we looked about at the disease concept chart. We understand that the remedy for the physical allergy is entire abstinence, and that means
don't drink.
Yeah. My problem is not in not understanding and not able to understand that. My problem is pulling that off. And so the problem is in my mind, the mental obsession. And so he's telling us that here.
He said, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body.
Now, the physical allergy is a real problem. But if I understand that I can't drink, period, then my problem is solved by my dealing with the mental obsession. The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than in the body.
Okay, so if you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth.
Not often. Not often. Once in a while, may tell the truth. Charlie said that an Al-Anon came to him and said to him, Charlie says, how do I tell when my husband Joe's telling the truth or when he's lying? Charlie says, that's easy. You watch his lips real close. And she says, is that right? He says, yeah. Watch his lips real closely. If they're moving, he's lying.
Yeah, buddy. He said, strange to say is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time. But in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. But they often suspect that they are down for the count.
The idea that someday, somehow, this is the alcoholic's national anthem, the singing of the alma mater, someday, somehow, I'll be able to get a grip on this thing. And we about die. That's why the solution centers in the mind rather than the body. How can I overcome that? How can I blot that out? How can I not say that again? Let's take a 7 minute. You told me that it takes 7 minutes to smoke a cigarette. Let's take a 7 minute break to get some coffee, smoke a cigarette, get rid of some coffee or whatever. Are we, Jerry?
Okay, is everybody with us on page 24, top of the page?
Flip over one page from where we were, where we ended up. We're over on page 24, first paragraph.
Okay, this whole paragraph is in squiggly writing, so let's just pay attention to what it says. Said, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent.
We found out how that worked already with Bill, didn't we? It didn't work very well with Bill, willpower.
He said, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink.
If we could see a drunk all the way through, we'd never take the first drink. But at certain times, I'm not able to remember, even though something may have happened quite recently, I'm unable to remember what happened. An obsession is defined in the dictionary as something in the mind which overpowers and overcomes all other information. And I know about the obsession. There are times when I cannot see the drink all the way through. If I could see the drink all the way through, it would go something like this. Last time I'd go in the liquor store and I'd say to the guy, last time I drank some of this, I about lost my job, I about lost my family, I about lost my home, they were ready to lock me up. How much will you charge me for a bottle of this stuff to do the same thing again? But I can't see that drunk all the way through. If I could see that drunk all the way through, I wouldn't buy that stuff, you see. But there are certain times when my mind will tell me, for some reason, that I can drink successfully. And that's the mental obsession.
You know, Dick just made a statement, we can't see a drink all the way through, and that's true. That is one of the problems that we alcoholics are, and that is the insanity that we're asked to be delivered from in step two. That's the insanity we talk about when we talk about step two. Have you ever had anybody come by your house and say, hey, let's go get this drunker and a skunk, wreck the car, spend a weekend in jail, and next week we can get divorced? Nobody says that. They said, let's go have a couple of drinks. Because a couple of drinks is as far as we can think. But when we get restored to sanity as a result of this program, we're going to be able to handle that a little bit better.
The almost.
He said the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted by the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
Bill uses a hot stove as an example here, and we know that if you put your hand on a hot stove once and burn yourself, you never stand around waiting for a chance to do that again. You know, your mind is not obsessed with that. And you can bring about, you can think about many, many other things in your own personal life. You can personalize this thing of something that you did one time, it went wrong, it caused you a lot of physical or emotional harm, and you never have been obsessed to do that again. But with alcohol, it's different.
We do. And I have done things like this physically that I have never done again and had no desire to. And yet, over and over and over again, I've done the things that bothered me just as bad as that. He said, the alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way, and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar, said to ourselves, for God's sake, how did I ever get started again? Only to have that thought supplanted by, well, I'll stop with the sixth drink. Or what's the use anyway? When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. Now that is an important statement, because we've been trying to tell you all since we've been in this chapter that the fellowship is not enough. And as loving and as wonderful as the fellowship is, we're all human. But it says here that we have placed ourselves beyond human aid. Okay, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane.
He wants to make this point to us that we placed ourselves beyond human aid, that willpower, personal power, is not sufficient to recover. If the fellowship was sufficient, the fellowship is made up of a bunch of persons like yourselves, and he's telling us that's not sufficient. We must go to a power greater than human power. Top of page 25, there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride.
Step four.
And the confession of our shortcomings.
Step five.
Which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had never dreamed. I mentioned that fourth dimension of existence again. The second time he's mentioned it. We still don't know what it is, and we're not going to tell you what that is. We're going to tell you what that is a little later, about that fourth dimension of existence. What Bill does in this particular paragraph, he tells a story that we sum up with this one handout, which is your next handout, entitled, What is the Solution? What happens with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we are older, some of us are older members, and the new member comes in, and we share our experience, our strength, and our hope, and we support the new person, and we help that, we take that person by the hand, and we help them come to believe, we help them to have the willingness to build something, we help them want to investigate what's kept this group sober when they suffered from the same fatal state of mind and body that I suffer from, and to pick up the set of spiritual tools laid at our feet. Those spiritual tools are the 12 steps of this program, which we help that person practice. And we know from what it says here that the outcome of that revolutionizes our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. And we have the personality change which is sufficient to recover from alcoholism. That entire psychic change that Silkworth talked about, didn't know how to produce it. But he knew that was necessary. We're going to hear Roland encounter with Dr. Carl Jung where he talks about change. Brings about the personality change sufficient to recover. And then those people become the older members who can begin the process all over again by sharing their experience, strength, and hope with the newer members. This is the entire solution in one. We're going to talk some more about it, but here's a capsule of the entire solution from the disease of alcoholism as we talk about in the next few chapters and paragraphs. It says the great... here's the second element in the cement that binds us together, which he talked about earlier. He says that we have found a common solution upon which we can absolutely agree. And he tells us right here what that common solution is. And I told you you wouldn't like it, that you wish there was some other. But he says the great fact is just this and nothing less, : that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences.
Asterisk.
Fully explained in Appendix Roman numeral 2, but that these effective spiritual experiences, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe, we saw that down at the bottom of that chart. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. This is the second element in the cement that binds us together, the common solution upon which we absolutely agree. The solution is that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. I'm sorry that all those other ideas that I wanted to be a part of that more important cement aren't. That the change in climate, the change in job, the change in exercise program, the change in eating habits, those other things that I mentioned are not the important element of the cement to bind us together. They're not the common solution upon which we absolutely agree, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. I put this asterisk in here and says, fully explained Appendix 2. I guess we ought to go back to Appendix 2 and see what he's talking about.
And that's on 569. I believe it's in both books on 569. I could be wrong, but I know it is on...
Appendix Roman spiritual experience.
Okay, now, this asterisk was added after the first big book came out. The first edition, first printing, did not have this asterisk, nor did it have Appendix 2. See, Appendix 2 was put into this book as a result of some of the discussion that they had heard from people that were reading the book. You know, when you read Bill's story, you find that deep and effective spiritual experience that he had, the very dramatic, unlooked-toward thing that Bill had. And some of the guys or some of the ladies in the program, not having had that experience, felt like the program really wasn't working. And they have since discovered that, and it's going to be explained in this appendix, that it's not necessary, that Bill's experience, while happens, is unusual. We're going to find out what the experience is, and that most of us don't have that kind of experience. We have like William James says, of the educational variety, you know, which is slow over a period of time. And neither one of them, don't feel slighted because you didn't have what Bill had, because there is no difference in the effectiveness of either one of them. Both of them are very effective in combating alcoholism, and one is no more effective than the other. So let's go back to page 569 and see what Bill says back here. He said the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading...
And we're not very good at that, so he alerts us here that we need to do some careful reading.
Yeah, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms.
I think what he says in this first paragraph is the key term, whether or not it's a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, whether or not it becomes sudden or whether it's slow, the William James variety, educational variety, as William James said, doesn't make any difference. The key to both of these is that the personality change comes about, and that change is sufficient to bring about recovery, sufficient to remove the mental obsession. That's the key.
He said, yet it's true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook.
That's certainly a spiritual experience. You can pinpoint it at time and place and a magnitude.
Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James called the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often the friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline.
That's a spiritual awakening, the slower educational variety that James talks about in his book of the variety of religious experiences. We didn't tell you this, but right after Bill had that spiritual experience in Towns Hospital, Abby brought him the book, Variety of Religious Experiences by William James, and Bill read that book and he understood it, and it supported what had happened to him in the hospital when he'd had that spiritual awakening or that spiritual experience. He understood that book. He's only sober 2, 3, 4 days. I got a copy of William James' Variety of Religious Experiences right now in my AA library stuff, and I don't understand it well today when I read it. Don't even like to read it. It's not good reading. Bill understood it. So this is why he refers to it. James talks about the slower educational variety of change, the spiritual awakening.
He says, with few exceptions, our members find they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves.
One of the other things we suggest that you might underline, because we're going to refer to it later, is the term tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of power greater than themselves. Tapped an unsuspected inner resource.
He said, most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program.
Squiggly writing.
Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable.
Indispensable. Dictionary defines that as absolutely necessary.
He said, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. That was by the Herbert Spencer.
Now, thank God for this explanation that's found in the book. Contempt might have kept us from having a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening. If I have to have a psychic change, I have to have a personality change, it helps me to understand what one is. Now, Bill loves to repeat himself and tell us different things with different words. One of the things he brings through on Appendix 2 of the spiritual experience is the need for change. The key word is change. And Bill's going to use different terms. Jerry's going to very quickly identify some of the phrases or words that Bill uses in here that mean change.
Okay, so, you know, I said Bill likes to use different words to say the same thing. On this one page, Bill uses the term change 12 different times. He uses 7 different words to say it. And he says he's saying the same thing over and over again. In the first paragraph up there, he says change. And then under that, he says changes again. And then he says upheavals. Well, an upheaval is to change something. And then in the next paragraph, he said revolutionary change. If you revolutionize something, you change it. Overwhelming. If you overwhelm something, you change it. And then he says change again. Then he says transformations.
Something that's transformed is change. See, he uses different words. All mean the same thing.
And then he says difference. So that's a change. And then down in and then the same paragraph, he says alteration. And to alter something is to change.
So you notice how Bill uses the word, when he wants to drive a point across, he says change is what this is all about. Change. And he uses several different words and phrases in Appendix 2 to bring that point across. If he'd have said change every time, we'd have thought, God, that's dull reading because he uses that term over and over again. Back to page 25.
Back on 25, last paragraph. He said, if you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there's no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives.
Got two alternatives now. We're at the fork in the road.
One was to go on to the bitter end, blocking out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could.
That's failing to understand the need for step one and step two.
And the other, to accept spiritual help.
To accept the provisions of step two and move on.
Okay, this we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. He said a certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character.
He's talking about Roland Hazard here. You're going to tell us a little story about Roland. Roland is comes from a very affluent New England industrialist family.